This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Steve Scher.
And I'm Marcy Silman. Steve, you have met the San Francisco writer Armistead Maupin, haven't you?
And we interviewed him. I loved him.
Yeah, he's great. More than 40 years ago, he started really a dynasty. Maupin created this fictional rooming house that he populated with a crazy cast of characters. Young gay man searching for his identity, the macho dude looking for ladies, a single career woman. It was all under the watchful eye of the landlady Anna Madrigal. Armistead Maupin tackled topics from the rise of HIV/AIDS to the rise of social media, and somehow before there was an internet, Maupin's tales went viral. Readers around the world passed them from friend to friend, and they became a book, three books, a television miniseries, a staged musical. Now Armistead Maupin ends that long-running series with his ninth novel. It's called The Days of Anna Madrigal. I asked him to go back to the very beginning and to explain to us who Anna Madrigal is.
Mrs. Madrigal is the landlady of a place called 28 Barbary Lane, which is a ramshackle old apartment building on Russian Hill in San Francisco in the mid-1970s when we start. We don't know for the first year or so of the story, for the first novel, that she's actually transgender. That was much more of a secret back in those days than it is today. But she presides over her brood, over her tenants in this old place, and she's a kind of mother figure without any of the unavoidable judgment that comes with parenthood.
Initially, the folks that she gathered to her in that rooming house that she ran were in their 20s, and they were the folks who discovered San Francisco in the 70s. Mm. It was a place...
And like me.
Like you. A place to reinvent yourself.
Yes. And I sort of put one of each in there. There's, you know, there's an old hippie with who's essentially bisexual. There's a young gay man who's from Orlando who's a who tomcats around but is really a romantic at heart. There's Marianne Singleton, a girl from Cleveland who is much smarter than people think she is. Brian Hawkins, who's kind of a horn dog, straight guy, but a sweet guy. I like him. They all cross each other's paths and become friends.
And now in this book, The Days of Anna Madrigal, we meet almost all the recurring characters and the new characters that have come on since you sort of took up the series again. We meet Mrs. Madrigal she's old. She's quite old. She has a caretaker, Jake Greenleaf, who's very young and also transgender. And everybody converges in an interesting way as you take these characters on the road.
Yes, so they're going to different places in Nevada. Anna wants to go back to Winnemucca, where in her boyhood, she grew up in a brothel. But she has some unfinished business, something that's weighing on her at 92. She hasn't been back to the town for 75 years. And then the others are all headed off to the Burning Man Festival in the Black Rock Desert. I've done this now 2 years in a row.
Burning Man?
Yeah. I had to be taken kicking and screaming by my husband Chris because I don't have a great fondness for dust and heat and hauling in my own water and food and raves that go on till dawn. I have to say, when I was there, I became quite enchanted by it.
Really?
It's a visual like you will never see ever anywhere on Earth. It is extraordinary. It's a city of these colored lights in the middle of nowhere, and you can ride your bicycle across these wide, flat plains.
I'm talking with Armistead Maupin, and we're talking about his final Tales of the City book, The Days of Anna Madrigal. One of the things I wondered about taking everybody on the road, I have always felt like San Francisco is a character. It's Tales of the City, and that city is San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things set there, as you said at the beginning, but I don't feel like I'm tied to the city. Obviously, I moved from it a year and a half ago, and certainly the characters aren't. They've always gone places. In other previous books, they went to Alaska and Great Britain, Mexico. This really, it wasn't any special design to snub the city. It had to do with, I only get those implications in San Francisco itself. But it was really about wanting to write about things that I knew about. And one of them was the Burning Man Festival. There was great material there. It's a place that serves my work really well because coincidence is everywhere. There are no cell phones out there. And so you just wander out into this city that's created overnight and disappears in a week. It's like a village. I described it as a Fellini carnival on Mars. But it was unavoidable. I had to do that. And I wanted to take Anna. I had a reason to take Anna back to her boyhood. And I could write about her boyhood in a way that I've never done before. I've always written in real time. And this was the first time I actually went back to an earlier day that I myself did not remember.
It's an interesting book about closure in a lot of ways, not just Anna's revisiting her youth, but a lot of the characters, everybody's getting older. And this is as much a book about what happens when you reach a certain point in life and what you start to think about, as opposed to what you thought about when you were 20.
Thank you. That's well observed. It is about that. Everybody's got a little something that they need to make reparations about, and they more or less do. But as Anna says towards the end of the book, there will be no tidying up, dear. She says it to she sees that Brian, who is now 67, is frantically trying to get everybody together, and she knows at her age that, you know, you basically what you do, and not just her age. I think once you passed 60, you basically joined the land of the old people. And you know at that point, there isn't any tidying up. You can't, doesn't mean there's not a happy ending, but you have to take each day as it comes and celebrate it and make sure you're on the right track with the people you love, that they're clear about that. And that's what happens in the book.
But it also struck me at a certain point, and I think it happens before 60, you look at things like Burning Man or, you know, wild romping sex lives or settling down in a different way than you do when you're 25 and you sort of feel immortal. You couldn't have written this book at 35 or 40.
No. I would have a hard time remembering the early, more hedonistic chapters now. People say to me, you can go back and fill in the places that you didn't write about. And I said, no, I can't, because I'm not that person anymore. And the strength of this book, these books, has been that I snatched those Easter eggs along the way. And I'm not even always conscious of making certain observations. I'll look at the books now and think, really, did I say that? And did I wear that? And did we do that?
A bit ago, you mentioned that you started these... You created these characters in the 70s. They were created for newspaper columns. They transformed into books. And then you ended the series once and came back to it. Mm. And you say you're ending it this time with this book.
Yeah, I know that makes me less trustworthy.
Yes, but... it does. But I guess why? Why now? Why is this the right
time? Well, why then is probably a better answer, because I had already established Michael as HIV positive. And back in those days, that was a death sentence. So I wanted to end the series without him dying at the end. That has been a tradition, or was for a long, long time, that people who were established as gay in popular fiction and movies had to pay for it. Mm-hmm. They paid for it at the end. They died. It might be touching, but they died. They paid for their sins. That was the attitude. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to have a story where the gay man died at the end. So I left him in a healthy HIV-positive state. And then the world changed, and the cocktails came along, and I wanted to write a novel about a man of roughly of my generation who had survived, because we lost so many people. That's why I don't complain about. I try not to complain about getting older, because it's a privilege that was not afforded to so many of my friends. Every morning I get up, I have a moment at life that they didn't have. But I didn't want to follow Michael into death. And when the time came to write a novel about somebody of my generation, I thought, well, I have somebody already. And the readers are familiar with his history even. Mm-hmm. So why not use it? So I shifted for the one and only time to a first-person narrative for Michael Tolliver Lives. and told his story in that way. I went back to that multi-character tapestry with Marianne and Autumn, and of course in the last book, The Days of Anna Madrigal, because I know how to do it really well,
right.
I think. And it works. It has power. You get to a certain point in the chapter, and then suddenly you're off to the next person, but you're curious about them too, and then you're back, and you can find out things that's going to happen to one of the other characters in another chapter. And
very Charles Dickens.
Thank you. That's a nice comparison to be made. But he did. He wrote serially as well, and
right.
He had people waiting for the ship in New York when the next installment came in because they wanted to know.
I mean, these characters, obviously they're fictional, but they are dear to generations of readers. How do you feel about leaving them?
It's funny. I don't think I'll ever leave them. I've left the series, and I do feel a tiny bit melancholy. I've felt it on the tour, and I think only because of the way it fits into my own life. I think this is a giant chapter of my own life. There's a little narcissism involved in my melancholy, I guess. But I also want the chance to do something else. I didn't have some vision that someone will scoop up the unfinished final chapter when I die. All along I've been trying to create a work of art, and I feel when a work of art really has to have a beginning and an end, or a shape to it, or whatever. And I feel good about that part of it. It's there, and it will be in one matched set of 9 books, and that people can return to them anytime they want. You know, they aren't dead per se. They live there in the pages.
So instead of Michael Tolliver lives, we could say Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City lives.
I hope so. I hope it'll be around for a while.
Thanks so much for coming by.
My pleasure, as always.